One of the words that Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings makes into a bell that keeps ringing is the word perilous. And he associates peril, a certain dangerousness, especially with human approaches to the elves. I think this is one of the deepest underlying themes of Tolkien's book. I think it's something that animates all of his imagination. I think it has a specifically Catholic form in Tolkien, and I'll try to bring some of that out in this talk. In particular, I'm going to show slides of some paintings, mostly from the 19th century, that would have been very much alive in the English culture of Tolkien's own day, not only in Catholic circles, but with a kind of special reflection within Catholic circles. So, that'll be the picture here. The Lord of the Rings is a fairly long book, about 1,000 pages. I'll only be able to read a few passages to illustrate these ideas. If you have other passages you would like to mention in the discussion, that would be great. Let me start with one passage that has become something of a favorite of mine. I don't know how many of you are readers of The Lord of the Rings, but one of the guys who's a good guy is Gandalf. Big hat, large crozier, staff. And you know he's a good guy. You're on his side. Here's something that happened. He and Frodo are sitting in the morning. No, it's not at night. That's in the movie. They're sitting in the morning in Frodo's comfortable house. And in the shadow of the past, Gandalf is explaining to Frodo the backstory of the ring, and particularly the importance of Gollum in that story. Gandalf tracked Gollum down, and here's what happened. This is Gandalf. I endured him as long as I could, but the truth was desperately important, and in the end I had to be harsh. I put the fear of fire on him and wrung the true story out of him bit by bit, together with much sniffling and snarling. He thought he was misunderstood and ill-used, but when he had at last told me his history, as far as the end of the riddle game and Bilbo's escape, he would not say any more except in dark hints. Some other fear was on him greater than mine. He muttered that he was going to get his own back. People would see, if he would stand being kicked and driven into a hole and then rot. Gollum had good friends now, good friends, and very strong. They would help him, beg him, pay for it. That was his chief thought. He hated Gollum, cursed his name. Gandalf is contemptuous of Gollum. You know that Gandalf's a good guy, so you become contemptuous of God. I endured him as long as I could, but the truth was desperately important. And in the end, I had to be harsh. I put the fear of fire on him and wrung the true story out of him, bit by bit, together with much sniffing and snarling. On the next page, we have this cheery thought. We find out something about the other fear that shut Gollum up, even when fear of fire was upon him. Aragorn finally tracked him down, beat him all the way across Wolderland. And here's what Gandalf says about that. What Gollum had been doing, he would not say. He only wept and called us cruel. with many a gollum in his throat. And when we pressed him, and he whined and cringed, and rubbed his long hands, licking his fingers as if they pained him, as if he remembered some old torture. But I'm afraid there's no possible doubt he had made his slow, sneaking way, step by step, mile by mile south, down at last to the land of Mordor. Torture. Well, you know that the people in Mordor are the bad guys. Gandalf, good guy. People in Mordor, bad guys. You read this. You may have read this 20 times. Each time, Gandalf was your moral hero. I put the fear of fire on him and wrung the true story out of him, bit by bit. Do you think Gollum was an idiot for thinking that Gandalf was a torturer? Did Tolkien think Gollum was an idiot? Tolkien lets you make the moral mistake of your judgmental superiority about God. But on the next page, he gives you the corrective to your mistake. Maybe to an American audience, although maybe you're too young, maybe if it is said, I put the fear of waterboarding on him and wrung the true story out of him bit by bit, maybe you'd hear it. After all, every torturer says the truth was desperately important, and in the end I had to be harsh. Now, I don't read that passage to show that Tolkien was a torturer, or to show that Tolkien had no moral compass. I read it to show how often readers have no moral compass when they think that Tolkien is written in a way that makes it easy to tell who's wearing a white hat and who's wearing a black hat. There's a moral complexity about Tolkien that's very different from the standard view of the Lord of the Rings as nothing but a little morality play. It is a morality play, but it's a morality play that understands some of the human costs of morality. Some of the human effort that's required for moral judgment. I want to think about this complexity by looking at what Tolkien does with the human experience of the elves. But before I read those three passages that I want to focus on, I want to start with a bit of backstory. Because I believe Tolkien's best understood not as a simply Christian writer, but as a specifically English writer, and particularly an English Catholic writer. I think Tolkien's own imagination participates in all of the cultural anxiety in the 1800s in England about the emergence of Catholicism within an officially Protestant culture. And I think that that set of anxieties often shows itself most potently in visual art, even though it's also important in literature. So, that's where I'm going to go. Let me start with this painting. Dante Rossetti's painting of the Annunciation. This is one of the very first of the Pre-Raphaelite paintings. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, the PRB, they put it on their painting, were a group of young men. They were the same age as you. I'm talking about the students here, not the old people here. And they created a revolution in art. And so you could do that too. You could do something. This is a standard religious painting, very popular Christian theme. Because it's a Marian theme, it has some complexities within certain kinds of Protestant circles, but it's a very popular genre painting. You can find whole books with nothing but reproductions of Annunciation. investigations.
So the angel Gabriel comes to the Virgin Mary and tells her that she's going to conceive Jesus Christ. The lily that Gabriel holds is a traditional symbol of Mary's purity and virginity. This turns out to be a controversial painting. It's controversial in part because the model of the Virgin Mary is Christina Rossetti, the painter Dante Rossetti's sister. Her attitude is not obviously the traditional one of ready submission, despite the title of the painting, called The Handmaid of the Lord. She seems rather to shrink in terror, as I would if a man with fired feet showed up in my bedroom. So there's a startling humanity, a rethinking, you might say, of the humanity of this scene, compared to many paintings in this genre, where Mary is painted in a much more contemplative posture. So, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood starts by painting a number of Christian paintings on very traditional themes, but they become controversial because the specific way that they present holiness through their own visual vocabulary is new. And it's perceived as more human, which some people like. But it's also perceived as failing to represent the holy subjects in a way befitting their holiness. Now, this painting is not terribly controversial. This one is. The painting's not that yellow in real life. So, Christ in the house of his parents. This is another very early PRB painting. John Everett Millais was probably the greatest of all of the Pre-Raphaelite painters, just as a painter. He's, I believe, 21 when he paints this painting. So, now, I take it most of us now, when we look at this painting, the first thought in our mind is not, what a shockingly, grotesquely realistic representation of the Holy Family. We see this painting as idealizing. That's not how a lot of contemporaries saw it. This painting is about as straightforward an allegorical painting as you could ask for. So you've got little Jesus there holding up his hand. You can't see it very well in the slide, but it has a hole in it. Right? He's been helping out carpenter Joseph, and he got a nail hole in his hand. And a drop of blood actually falls down on his foot there. That might be prefiguring. Huh. Like my first year students always say, is that foreshadowing? And Jesus' mother is kneeling there, just like she is in a thousand crucifixion scenes. So it's playing off a whole genre of crucifixion paintings. In case you didn't know, this little boy here with the baptismal water is little Johnny the Baptist. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. You can see the implements of crucifixion. Not only the nails, but the ladder going up, the wood. Off to the side, there are some sheep gathered behind a fence. Part of the reason that was controversial is that looked an awfully high church, even Catholic. The sheep of the congregation away from the altar, which is what that table is. So, this is a very high church Christian genre painting.
It is controversial in part for being high church within a more evangelical culture. Charles Dickens, an evangelical himself, wrote an angry screed against this painting when he saw it.
Said that the Virgin Mary, you could find better looking women in any gin shop in England.
So when Charles Dickens looked at this picture, he did not see idealization. He saw realism that was actually an attack on the sacredness of its subjects. So you get used to a certain visual vocabulary of idealization as a representation of holiness or sacredness. And then when there's a shift, it takes a while for people to adjust to that. Is that adjustment a good thing or a bad thing? Now that's a more interesting question. Certainly at first, this often seemed like a shocking painting. I think it's virtually impossible for us to see this as a shocking painting. How about that?
You need a little Catholic lore
to recognize that painting. So that's St. Sebastian,
the patron saint of, among other things, archers.
There's irony in the church.
And of athletes,
because there's a Greek word that's the root of athlete means suffering.
So, St. Sebastian, now this painting is from the early 1600s,
and this became a very famous painting at the same time as the Pre-Raphaelites. It was Oscar Wilde's favorite painting, he said.
He said a lot of things that weren't really true for a fact, and that was one of these. When this painting was originally displayed, it was made for a church. The story goes that the priests hearing confessions began to hear in the confessional from the female parishioners that they found this painting an occasion of sin because it was too sexualized. And it is sexualized. The violence of martyrdom is combined with the lusciousness of male flesh exposed. I mean, that loincloth is not doing its work.
By the late 1800s, this painting had become a homoerotic icon. Regularly, it's referred to in the writings of men who want to express their own sexual attraction, their erotic interest in other men.
Now, I don't think that's actually Guido Reni. Not Guido.
When he painted this, he certainly did not intend it that way. What did he intend?
He intended, first of all, to present this martyred saint in the image of a crucifixion scene. That's why the hands are elevated the way they are. And it's why one of the arrows is in the side where Christ was pierced by a spear. So there's a bit of a quotation of a crucifixion visual vocabulary. But he is painting it as a statement of a counter-reformation spirituality that means to challenge a kind of containment of beauty within a more Protestant understanding, or at least a Calvinist understanding, of the place of beauty within religious practice. So this is an aggressively Catholic painting. It shouldn't be a surprise, then, that by the late 1800s, this painting is Exhibit A in Protestant polemics against the softness, the sensuousness, and always just under the surface and sometimes above the surface, the painting from the 1600s meant one thing when it was painted in the early 1600s. By the late 1800s, the Pre-Raphaelite age, it means something different. It's the fleshiness, the sensuousness. And the question is, does the sensuous beauty and our response to it in this painting simply overcome its religious purpose, however intended? Does beauty overflow the spiritual vessel and in fact cover it over? It is a great painting, but it's not clear that it elevates one's heart and mind to the greatness of martyrdom. Its sexuality, which is surely part of it, and its violence, it's the combination, it's the synergy between sexuality and violence that gives us the punch of the religious reality of martyrdom. Sexuality and violence individually are both intensifiers of experience, just as they were in that passage I read from Tolkien. That wasn't yet sexualized. That was only made violent. But they're intensifications of experience. When you put them together, they're not just two intensifiers. Now they're a new kind of intensifier. So that's part of what's happening here. This is a painting by Edward Burne Jones, around about 1880. Burne Jones was the most important of all the Pre-Raphaelite painters. He was in the second generation. So this is 1880 or so. Edward Burne Jones went to the same grammar school that Tolkien went to. They're different generations. It's the same school. And he was the most famous graduate of that school, Edward Burne Jones. Tolkien, without a doubt, was suffused with an atmosphere in which Edward Burne Jones was a cultural icon. And the particular type of art he produces is iconic. He produces much religious art, and he produces much art that we would be more tempted to call mythical. But it's not clear what the difference is between the two. So this I put up because this is an example of another PRB annunciation scene. It's actually quite an interesting painting. There's a lot going on in it. But all I'm really interested in right here is in the figure of Mary, because she looks just like all the other beautiful women in Edward Burne Jones's paintings. And she is almost entirely featureless.
She doesn't look like a particular person. She is idealized woman. Now, you can imagine that having a strong theological point. Especially because, although you can't really see it in a projection,
in the upper left corner of that arch, there's actually a representation of Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden.
This was fairly common with Annunciation paintings. So that it projects Mary onto Eve as the typical, the exemplary woman. So you can see a theological point in, so to speak, erasing the particularity of Mary and presenting her beauty in a way that is pure type. There could be a theological point to doing what Edward Burne Jones did here. But here's his most famous painting, called The Golden Stair, which is a whole bunch of more or less identical young women who all look like Virgin Mary from the Annunciation going down a big stair, holding musical instruments. One of them is actually the big sister of the woman who was Alice in Wonderland. So some of them are based on real girls from around Oxford. But this painting is one of the greatest visual statements of the slogan, "I'm spiritual but not religious." It has all the form of an Annunciation painting. It has the women, but most of all, at the very top, there's an opening in the ceiling, and there are some doves up there. Because in Annunciations, the dove as the Holy Spirit is flying toward Mary at the moment she conceives Jesus Christ. The difference is that this painting replaces a directly religious interpretation of transcendence with the notion that it's art that's transcendent, both the painting itself and the musical instrument that the women carry. So that whatever Burne-Jones has done is to take over a Christian religious visual vocabulary and turn it into a statement that says, I can get from art what we used to try to get from Christianity. Now, that's a reduction of the complexity of Edward Burne-Jones' art. It's a caricature of it. But there's something right about that. That is part of his project. To, so to speak, find the spiritual power of Christianity without the spiritual meaning of Christianity. This is the atmosphere in which Tolkien grows up intellectually. An atmosphere dripping with very sensuous pain that starts out on a Christian trajectory but ends up in what you might call a symbolism trajectory or a mythic trajectory that doesn't want to be controlled by specifically Christian understandings of the content of the art. One of the most shocking of all Pre-Raphaelite like paintings is this one, which is a little later than Edward Burne-Jones by John Waterhouse. Saint Eulalia sent the story of Saint Eulalia. She was a relatively young girl. A Roman official wanted to marry her. She refused. She wanted to preserve her virginity and live a specifically Christian life. And so she was martyred. To humiliate her, she was stripped, her corpse was stripped naked, but miraculously, there was a snowfall that covered her nakedness. That's the story. What John Waterhouse has done is to paint a painting that is either a tremendously powerful modern embodiment of the meaning of martyrdom, or an utter perversion and blasphemy of the power of martyrdom in order to still enjoy the intensity of martyrdom, but without the spiritual discipline martyrdom implies. So this painting has that story, right? There's Saint Eulalia lying dead, and there's snow about to cover her, and there are a bunch of doves, so you know the Holy Spirit sending the snow. But of course, the doves are kind of naturalized. Maybe they're just doves. And the snow, how miraculous is it? Not miraculous to cover up her perky breasts. The main visual interest of this painting would actually seem to be the naked female form presented to us as something sexually available and beautiful, rather than to intensify our spiritual appreciation of martyrdom. Not only is the sexuality of the picture very striking, so is the violence of it. Obviously partly because she's been martyred. She's dead. But look at her beautiful red hair, a typical Pre-Raphaelite thing. Her blood has been turned into her sexualized red hair. And over here on what is her right hand, on her wrist, there's a little S&M bondage thing going on. Right? There's a little bit of rope around there. What's that doing there? It's doing the same thing that it does in the St. Sebastian painting. It sexualizes the violence.
So this picture, coming toward the end of the energy of the Pre-Raphaelite movement, is one that, in a directly Christian-themed painting, seems to present us a very hard challenge. How do we preserve a Christian response, even to a Christian-themed painting, when it's cast into this new sensuous vocabulary? This is the last of these paintings I want to look at. This is a much earlier painting. John Everett Millais, Christ in the House of His Parents. So, big controversy about how that painting, that Christ in the House of His Parents painting, how can that be an authentically Christian painting? It doesn't idealize enough. It looks like it undermines our response to the Holy Family and Sacred. He decided to paint an even more dangerous painting. So this is his next important painting. This is actually a story that comes ultimately from Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, but then is put into a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson, and he's the immediate source of the story of the painting. Mariana is a fallen woman who is in exile, and part of the movement of the play Measure for Measure is whether she'll get back together with the man who has jilted her. Millais has presented Mariana in an utterly sexualized way. The gorgeousness of the colors of the dress, particularly of the belt that emphasizes her hips. In case you needed more, you've got the mouse and the fallen leaves, which are emblems of her fallenness. But on the other hand, there is, in the background, a private altar. There's actually a holder of incense there, along with the candles, and there's a diptych. That is, she's presented as Catholic. And in fact, is doing things that would have been considered idolatrous in the official Protestant culture of England in which this painting comes into being. But to make our response even more complicated to it, John Everett Millais paints in the window a stained glass window as well. And that window is a picture of the Annunciation. So he gives us a modern painting of a fallen woman who we respond to not by thinking, shame on her, she's fallen, but by thinking, she is incredibly delicious. You can say everything you want about, well, yes, but it shows she's fallen. Well, that's not what our eyes respond to. She's not presented to us as fallen. She's presented to us as beautiful and sexy. And in fact, there seems to be some commentary here in suggesting that this is a Catholic problem. She's presented to us as Catholic by the altar, and John Everett Millais pushes all of the buttons by presenting the Annunciation itself as emblematic of the difficulty of responding to Mariana's sexuality in a spiritually appropriate way. Because the Annunciation might as well be called the conception in Mary's womb. That's what happened at the Annunciation. So that the story of the Annunciation to Mary is the moment of incarnation. All of the difficulties, religious, theological, philosophical, cultural, about coming to terms with the way
Transcendence now comes down and lives in human form, in human life. All of those problems are summed up in the Annunciation. I don't know that John ever Millay had an interpretation of his painting. What he had were intersecting lines of force that come together with his painterly skill in producing this painting. Is this an authentically religious painting? If the interpretation can be controlled by the Annunciation scene in the window, this can be a powerful religious painting. Indeed, an Orthodox Christian painting. Mary will be the type of Mariana as she escapes from her followers. But of course, it can be read in the other direction. You can pull the Annunciation right out of the window into our sensuous response to Marianne. And that's the question of whether a religious tradition that countenances that kind of art isn't just an indulgence. An indulgence in myths that actually are just projections of a deformed sexuality. So, that's a set of cultural anxieties that the visual art of Tolkien's own place and time makes a burning issue for Catholic artists. And that's one of the things Tolkien assuredly is. He comes out of what I would say, with some oversimplification, he comes out of a pre-Raphaelite background. That's where the cultural issues are. So, when Tolkien writes about the attractiveness of the realm of fairy, or to use the terms more often used in The Lord of the Rings, the attractiveness of the elves to human beings, I believe he is thinking about the problems that this art represents. How do we combine transcendence with the sensual beauty, including the intensifications of sexuality and violence, that seem to be the vehicles, the ladder we climb to that transcendence? So, I want to look at three passages from Tolkien that seem to me to really raise this question in a very specific way. Will it be a moral hazard to you if I leave that painting up? It's interesting about our time that could only be a joke. Could I leave any painting up there that was a moral hazard? I think it's probably an occasion of sin for me. I'm not sure. I mean, where do your eyes go in a painting? Do they go to her hips and her belt? Or do they go to the angel Gabriel and Mary? But I'll leave it there and let you decide. There are three passages I find very striking, and Tolkien clearly intends us to read these passages together. Three important human heroes in the story all express doubts and reservations about the entrance of human beings into elvish realms. Elvish realms are enchanting, their beauty is powerful, and it is hard to leave. Let me first just read a passage that brings this out. You'll remember that Frodo and the other members of the company had to be blindfolded when they came into Lothlorien. When the blindfolds are taken off, they have a sudden vision of the beauty all around them, which is a distinctively elvish beauty.
I think that this is self-evidently a passage where Tolkien is describing the beauty of Lothlorien in terms that he's drawing from Pre-Raphaelite art. Here's what he says. So this is when Frodo's blindfold is taken off. Frodo stood a while, still lost in wonder. It seemed to him that he had stepped through a high window that looked on a vanished world. Tolkien there is making use of Keats's Ode to a Nightingale. It seemed to him, to Frodo, that he had stepped through a high window that looked on a vanished world. A light was upon it, for which his language had no name. All that he saw was shapely. The shapes seemed at once clear-cut, as if they had been first conceived and drawn at the uncovering of his eyes, and ancient, as if they had endured forever. Both incredibly fresh, but incredibly classic, which is the way people experience Pre-Raphaelite art. He saw no color but those he knew, gold and white and blue and green, but they were fresh and poignant, as if he had at that moment first perceived them and made for them names, new and wonderful. Obviously, Adam naming the animals in the new and wonderful Eden. In winter here, no heart could mourn for summer or for spring. No blemish or sickness or deformity could be seen in anything that grew upon the earth. On the land of Lorien, there was no stain. And the word stain is another of those words that Tolkien makes into a bell that rings constantly. The unstained world, the world of a new Eden, that the humans have entered by entering an elvish realm. Is it good for us to be there? Those of you who know your Bible have probably heard that question before. Lord, it's good that we're here, which is what Peter said at the Transfiguration. He didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but that is what he said. Because at moments of transcendent beauty that are an epiphany of the presence of God, the word good is too small. Oh, it's good I'm here. Good? It seems like that's beyond good and evil, doesn't it? But if it's beyond good and evil, then it's not so easy to control morally. Before they enter Lothlorien, Boromir expresses reservations in talking with Aragorn. Boromir says, "Is there no other way?" "What other fairer way would you desire?" said Aragorn. "A plain road." Notice the contrast. Fair versus plain. Ah, but you know Aragorn's the good guy. So you're all on the side of beauty and fairness. I mean, why would you be on the side of plainness? Unless you were a Calvinist. "A plain road, though it led through a hedge of swords," said Boromir. "By strange paths has this company been led, and so far to evil fortune. Against my will, we passed under the shades of Moria to our loss, and now we must enter the Golden Wood, you say. But of that perilous land we have heard in Gondor, and it is said that few come out who once go in. And of that few, none have escaped unscathed." Aragorn, being a Catholic rather than a Calvinist, says, "Say not unscathed, but if you say unchanged, then maybe you will speak the truth." "But lore wanes in Gondor, Boromir. If in the city of those who once were wise, they now speak evil of Lothlorien." It'd be like being afraid to go into St. Peter's in Rome, right? I mean, what bad thing could happen to you there? Beautiful museum. "Believe what you will, there is no other way for us," Aragorn says to Boromir. Then lead on, said Boromir, but it is perilous. Perilous indeed, said Aragorn. Fair and perilous. In case you didn't hear the bell ring on perilous, he says it four times. Perilous, it's perilous, perilous, perilous. Fair and perilous. And here's what Aragorn says. Because you might wonder, well, if it's so perilous, why are we going there? Hey, I'll take you to the museum in London. We'll go see John Everett Boyes, Mariana, in real life. And you will be moved to the center of your being. And you say, well, that sounds kind of perilous. I said, well, it's fair and perilous. I mean, why are you so worried about that? Because I might never get that picture out of my mind. Well, if you're so worried about pictures of women, how about this? We'll go see Guido Reni St. Sebastian. Will that be okay for you? I mean, man, that sounds a little perilous too. Well, yeah, but they're religious paintings. Don't worry about it. It's okay. As long as it's religious, it's not a big deal. Because, of course, the fact that there are religious figures will control your response. It won't be your disordered sexuality that controls your response. I mean, come on. He's a saint. Right? Who can have a kind of creepy kind of sexual thing going on in St. Sebastian? I admit the arrows are a little funny, but it's okay. Boromir thinks it's perilous. Aragorn says, it's perilous if you're a bad guy. Only evil need fear it, or those who bring some evil with them. Follow me. I bring evil with me everywhere I go. I don't know about you. Ever since the fall of man, we bring evil with us everywhere we go. Is Aragorn your model? Really? Is Aragorn your model for what's safe for you to do? You know, he's been living with elves his whole life. Have you? Are you so at home in Rivendell, in Lothlorien, so at home that beauty does not disturb your moral equilibrium? Well, if you know Aragorn's your hero, and you know Boromir, something bad happens, so I don't want to spoil the story for anybody. If you know that already, you know whose side you're on. Boromir, God, what a dumbass, doesn't even want to go see the elves. Boromir, you can see how he creates problems. A little later on, there's another important warrior, Éomer, the leader of the military wing of the people of Rohan. When they meet up with Gimli the dwarf and Legolas the elf and Aragorn the Wat, the man who's got a whole bunch of elf stuff, Éomer, the leader of the men of Rohan, says to Aragorn, strange is your raiment, they're dressed in elvish cloaks. Have you sprung out of the grass? How did you escape our sight? Are you elvish folk? No, says Aragorn. One only of us is an elf, Legolas, from the woodland realm in distant Mirkwood. But we have passed through Lothlorien, and the gifts and favor of the lady go with us. Aragorn thinks he's showing, not only are we safe, we're better than you. You better listen to me. Well, that's not how Éomer thinks about this lady of Lothlorien. The rider looked at them, that is Éomer, looked at them with renewed wonder, but his eyes hardened. And he says, then there is a lady in the Golden Wood, as old tales tell. Few escape her nets. Hear the word escape again, Boromir's word. Few escape her nets, they say. These are strange days. But if you have her favor, then you also are net weavers and sorcerers may be. Now, he's not quite as negative as Boromir, but he's extremely wary of entering an elvish realm or of people who inhabit an elvish realm. Now, both of these passages, both the Aragorn-Boromir passage and the Aragorn-Tamir passage, elevate Aragorn by showing him as somebody who could be at home with the elves. Could see them as a place of unadulterated refuge. Just as when Frodo's eyes are unveiled, when the blindfold's off, and he sees the beauty of that realm. Nothing in that passage that shows us Lothlorien as unseen indicates that there's any human problem about being in a place that's unseen. It's all on the side of getting as elvish as you can. The whole painting is controlled by the elvish part, the stained glass window part. The whole painting's like a stained glass window with all those beautiful reds and blues and greens. Don't be a Boromir. That sounds like it should be a kid's song, doesn't it? Those two passages, left to their own devices, present a picture of humans entering an elvish world as an unadulterated and unstained good thing. But there's one more passage. This one is with Faramir. Faramir, the man of Gondor, who is of higher rank, higher spiritual rank, either than his brother Boromir, or than Amir, who comes from the lower culture of Rohan. When Frodo and Sam are with Faramir in Ithilien, they're captured, found, it's not quite clear how to describe that. After a certain amount of food and wine, which I find often helps conversation along, that's probably a form of Catholic corruption. Sam has dropped his suspicious and wary attitude toward Faramir. And he says to Faramir, because he's thinking, boy, this Faramir, he's a very elevated guy, and I've heard him say a couple of things about elves. I'd like to hear more, because Sam is addicted to Edward Burne-Jones. He loves elvish stuff. Sam says, "You don't say much in all your tales about the elves, sir." And Faramir says, "No, indeed, Master Samwise, for I am not learned in elven lore. But there you touch upon another point in which we have changed, declining from Numenor to Middle-earth. For, as you may know, if Mithrandir was your companion, that is Gandalf, and you have spoken with Elrond back in Rivendell, the Edain, the fathers of the Numenorians, fought beside the elves in the first wars and were rewarded by the gift of the kingdom in the midst of the sea within sight of Elvenhome." That story does not have an altogether happy ending either. But there was a time in the distant past when humans lived in great intimacy with elves. Not exactly with elves in the same place, but very close with elves and as close allies of elves. That's what it was like back in the day. But, and there's always a but, when it comes to the sensuous experience of the transcendent. But in Middle Earth, men and elves became estranged in the days of darkness, and all of our days are darkness, by the arts of the enemy, and by the slow changes of time in which each kind walked further down their sundered roads. Men now fear and misdoubt the elves, says Faramir, and yet know little of them. And we of Gondor grow like other men, like the men of Rohan, just in case you'd forgotten about Éomer's doubt about the elves. For even they, who are foes of the Dark Lord, shun the elves and speak of the Golden Wood with dread. Right? That's exactly what we heard Éomer say to Aragorn. So, Faramir, you might be thinking, well, okay, Faramir, he's like Aragorn. He likes the elves. He thinks the suspicion of people like Boromir and of Éomer is a mistake. He's on Aragorn's side. What do you mean you don't want to go to Lothlórien? I mean, we got to go. It's like Disney World. We got to go. That's not what Faramir says, though. And this is the last of these three passages that clearly are supposed to be read together. Faramir says, "Yet there are among us still some who have dealings with the elves when they may, and ever and anon one will go in secret to Lórien, seldom to return. Not I." And here is his principle. "I deem it perilous now for mortal man willfully to seek out the elder people," that is the elves. "Yet I envy you that have spoken with the White Lady." Tolkien is trying to manage a cultural anxiety about what it's like to enter the world of the elves, a world that we enter primarily through the beauty of art. It's the enchantment of elvish beauty, visual beauty, and especially musical beauty, that changes us. Faramir suggests that he deems it perilous for mortals to enter into the elvish realm, to think, for example, that art can replace Christianity, that art has now taken over, perhaps at a higher level of intensity, the very spiritual transcendence that the common people always just sought in Christian practice. But Tolkien lines up these three passages: Aragorn, Boromir, Aragorn, Éomer, and Sam and Faramir. He lines them up because the punchline is, "I deem it perilous, and yet I envy you." Because Tolkien doesn't let you wear a white hat or think that a character is wearing a black hat without chastening your own claims. Our claim that somehow we can enter unstained into an unstained realm, that we can wash away all the stain of travel in this world of men and women, our claim to do that is a false claim. It's a prideful claim. And I think one of the great powers of the Lord of the Rings is to force us to confront our great desire to make that claim, even if we only make that claim while we're experiencing art, while we're inside an elvish realm, this time not in Rivendell or Lothlórien, but inside a reading of The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien's anxiety is the same anxiety, I think, that we should face when we try to understand our own response to the new forms of religious intensity that the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood tried to produce with their visual vocabulary. Tolkien's is a Pre-Raphaelite book for people with enough moral judgment to understand how dangerous and perilous that kind of art can be. Thank you.
Great. Now, a little bit of time for questions. So if anybody has questions, go ahead and raise your hand, and we will go and see. Yes.
Yes.
How do you think it embodies the perilous beauty of Lilith? And do you think it does it properly because she is almost evil subject?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Rossetti painted many paintings of dangerously alluring women. Lilith is one of those paintings, but hardly the only one. So I think that Rossetti... I think Rossetti's artistic imagination constantly associated beauty with being killed. And so, for me, his most paradigmatic painting is actually one called Proserpina. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous painting. But when he paints these beautiful, alluring women, there's often some aspect of the artist dying to that one woman. And one another of his most famous paintings is from Dante, Beatrice. So that story of how the artist dies for his muse seems to me to have run through almost everything he did. Whether this is an art or in life, I'm not sure you can tell there was a difference of that. So I think the Lilith painting is another painting like that of his. Part of what I find interesting about the Annunciation painting, that early painting that I showed of his, this is partly because it was his sister who was the model, not one of these women he fell in love with. I think that's a more controlled painting. And actually, in some ways, a better painting than a lot of the more sumptuous paintings that he does later on in his career. So, to my eye, Rossetti becomes something of a self-parody because of the way he goes with the sensuousness, says, oh, I'm going to be captured by sensuous beauty. I love some of those paintings, but I don't think it's an altogether healthy book.
Thank you. You
talked a lot about one of the paintings that you showed about the spiritless beauty in sensuality and violence. But we also see a lot when we think about Lothlórien and other places in Lord of the Rings with regards to the elves. The beauty is not always the sensual beauty. And then in the Moriana painting, there's the idea of like what you're attracted to her hips or to the picture of the Annunciation. So is it dangerous also not only for looking to the beauty and sensuality and following the sensuality that leads to sin, but also just to have your attention distracted from the actual sacred?
The question of whether, come back to Tolkien after saying a little bit more about this problem of distraction. And I think this really is a central problem. So here's an example. A Catholic might shop around for a parish based on how good the music is. Some parishes have terrible. Others have glorious music. Students who go to Notre Dame, I don't know, maybe it's through Baylor too, but students who go to Notre Dame who like really good choirs and stuff get used to choirs that have a whole bunch of really talented people. And they think, man, that's the way Catholic music ought to be. And then they graduate, they
issue is, are you just being distracted by musical beauty? So what you're shopping for is an hour on Sundays that has at least some musical interludes that are reasonably enjoyable. Or are you shopping for a parish where the sensuous beauty of the music is more prayerful for you? Exactly because the sensuous beauty is a better vehicle of preference. So, I think we're in a constant state of both of those things being true. This is part of what I think is very powerful about Tolkien. Tolkien, surely he wants the Lord of the Rings to be something that a Christian, and especially a Catholic, but not just a Catholic, reads with a deep sense of spiritual satisfaction. That here, my own religious hopes and aspirations find an answer in a work of art. And the story articulates and indeed strengthens those legitimate Christian spiritual aspirations and hopes. That's what he wanted. But surely there are many readers who read it in the same spirit as Edward Burne-Jones' paintings, who thought, hey, I get everything Christians get, but I'm going to put up with the discipline of being in a church. So the beauty frees itself, if that's the right description, frees itself from its more specifically Christian roots and can provide a satisfaction that's understood as spiritual but not religious. Tolkien would have been horrified to be appropriated under the slogan, I'm spiritual but not religious. But it seems to me the evidence is he's very easy to appropriate in that way. And people have different vocabularies for it. They like that it's mythic. Well, that's another way to express the unspiritual but not religious thing. So, the beauty can be a distraction exactly when it's most effective. It's not just that the singing was so good at Mass last weekend that I forgot what it was about. It's that it might be I'm distracted exactly by realizing what it's about and thinking that the elevation I feel is more an aesthetic matter than it is a religious matter. So distraction can work at different levels.
Thank you. Other questions?
If you want, you just shout too. That's fine.
How do you think Catholics and Christians today should navigate this kind of balance between the beauty that God has given, the beauty in the things that God gives, and that elevating them to glorify God versus the perilous beauty? And how do we kind of keep on our guard on that day to day?
I don't think that there's any solution. I think that the Faramir passage really sticks with me here. Faramir doesn't want to be rid of the attractiveness of the elves, but he's very wary about how one can indulge it. I think beauty just is perilous. And so, I think that somebody with a Catholic sensibility, although American Catholicism is pretty Protestant, but somebody with a richer historical Catholic sensibility, who doesn't want an ugly church, but actually a beautiful church, I think that you constantly have to realize that there are fake ways of experiencing that beauty. But I don't think
that possibility justifies stripping beauty away in a kind of spirit of iconoclasm, a spirit of whitewashing the church, or of destroying statues, or of making the music boring, or indeed taking the music out. At my home institution at Notre Dame in the early 1990s, there was a wonderful playing out of these problems. The basilica, the big church, after a century of people with incense and candles in it, it was peachy. And they had a big project to clean it up and redo the original colors and all the gilding and everything. Well, a lot of people hated it because to them, spirituality went along with a kind of somber calm. And so, all of a sudden, they looked like a bunch of vulgar Italians who built the church, which was true. Right? So I went back to look at Italian. It wasn't Northern European, boring German anymore. So, these kinds of things are absolutely real. And I think that the moral hazard of the perilousness of beauty is, I think it's justifiable to run the risk of that moral hazard, that it captures us as mere sensuous beauty. Because I don't think that the perilous beauty goes all the way into simply being an occasion of sin. But the line between acceptable moral hazard and inappropriate occasion of sin is one that is not very easy to draw. But I don't think it's very easy to be a human being in that particular respect. So that's where I would say it. I think we could see the same problematic in a lot of other aspects of human life. Really, how good looking should you try to be? Should you dress up? What's that mean when you dress up? I mean, partly it means you make yourself sexually attractive. Well, at least if you're young enough to accomplish that goal. So, should we stop doing that? It's actually really hard to stop doing that because clothes that you think are modest, it turns out, actually are still sexually attractive. So, once you get into this mindset that the perilousness of beauty is an occasion of sin, that is to say, is sinful itself, there is no stopping it. You will never find a suitably beauty-blocking experience of the world, it seems to me. So, I can wear a tie. So, now I've elevated my personal beauty. So now I'm only a moral hazard. I'm not an occasion of sin anymore. What the hell does that mean? Right? So I think this is a very general human issue. I think that the legitimate desire for purity very easily degenerates into an illegitimate demand for simplicity. And I take part of my own vocation as a teacher to block that. But lots of other people think I'm just a culture.
Well, with that, we will end things today. We thank again very much, Professor Connor.
Thanks for coming.